Today is December the 13th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key in the Progressive Radio Network studio. WBAI is in a membership drive tonight, and our program has been preempted. Podcasts of this program, The Personal Computer Show, is available on PRN.FM and on our website, PCRadioShow.org. And boy, is it cold today in New York. And next week, well, it'll be the first day of winter. I just hope it gets a little warmer. But first, let's get to some of the important news of the past week. We have a couple of bug fix alerts to let everyone know about. Microsoft has notified everyone that there's been a major critical malware flaw that was found, and it has not affected anyone that they know of. That's the good news. And the good news is they're saying before they even announced that they fixed it, they didn't want anyone to know about it. But this has to do with Windows Defender, with Windows 8 and above, and Microsoft Security Essentials. And it has to do with remote code execution. It was discovered by one of the research people. They notified Microsoft. They worked on it immediately, and I'm glad they caught it. And let's say that no foul, no harm. Well, foul in the sense that they found it. That's the good news. The other thing, however, is that this is a, you know, when we talk about Defender and Security Essential, that's pretty, that's pretty recent, relatively speaking. But it was also discovered that a 17-year-old Microsoft Word bug was discovered. And this is something. This goes back to Microsoft Office that affects Word in Office 2007, 2010, 2013, and 2016. And this has to do with the fact that there is a bug that if you happen to have an RTF document, and I don't know how many people, actually use a, write an RTF, I do. And this has to do with the fact that malicious code could be buried in an RTF document. And this affects, and this is the fortunate thing, because I don't think there are that many people, maybe not, okay, who are working with Visa, that's V-I-S-A, you know, the Visa credit card, PayWave service. So if you had an incoming RTF document and you got, let's say you got fooled into opening it, and it could affect Visa PayWave service. This is a bug that was discovered. They feel that it's somewhat minimized because you have to be in administrative mode. By the way, one of the things we always tell people is that when you install your system and you set it up, just set up another user account other than your administrative account. In the administrative account, you can change programs by saying, yes, you can do it. In the case of non-administrative, you can't. And as far as I'm concerned, just about everything else could be run in non-administrative unless you happen to be installing or uninstalling something. So keep that in the back of your mind. The third one is another bug fix that I want to announce, and this has to do with HP. They had announced that they discovered that there was a, they have software from a third party, Synaptics, and they discovered that the keylogger is disabled by default in the Synaptics software, and you need administrative permission to be able to take advantage of it. But be as it may, just in case someone turns on the keylogger for whatever reason, first of all, it shouldn't be there to begin with. So HP has said that it has affected, now get this, 475 different models of laptops. 303 of them are the Spectra, Envy, Pavilion, Omen, and Compact. They all contain the keylogger. A patch has been delivered by HP. It was delivered just yesterday. You should get that patch in. What it does is that it deletes the keylogger and it sets up everything properly. The good news is that HP has notified everyone. And at first, when I saw it, I said that it affected nearly 500 of its notebooks. I was thinking like only 500, notebooks were affected. No, 475 models of their notebooks. That's a lot. Now, the good news is HP has attended to it, but I'll tell you what the bad news is. The one who discovered it says this problem with Synoptics is a third-party vendor that HP use to supplement some of the drivers they have. And this is the same software in other models of manufacturer notebooks. They haven't made any mention of it. Maybe they've discovered it. Maybe they fixed it. I don't know. But if you don't have an HP notebook, check into it. And there are keylogger detection programs available. Try running it. And let's find out if you have anything. But now, if you are impatient and you want to know if you're affected, let me give you the following, all right? If you've got a paper and pencil, if not, you can come back to this. C, like in Charlie, 058-27409. Let me repeat that. C, like in Charlie, 058-27409. So just do a search on HP support with that number, or actually it's not a number, it's a code, okay? And it'll get you right to the URL and the security bulletin, and it lists all 500 models of the notebook, so you can find out whether you've been affected or not. So let me repeat that again. Charlie, that's C for Charlie, 058-27409. And people would say to me, how come I didn't give the URL? Unfortunately, these URLs are long. They are long. You know, in the HP... PC systems, I'm sorry, not HP, but PC systems, it's really, it's kind of hit rock bottom. It's starting to come back up again. And HP has been quite successful in their turnaround, whereas some of the other manufacturers have been losing business. They have been gaining business. And one of the reasons why they've been gaining business is that there has been a form factor that people got a hold of, and they like it. That's a two-in-one convertible. The two-in-one convertible is really a notebook where the screen is detachable, and it's more than just a screen being detachable. It's like you could use it as a tablet because the system board is in the screen itself. And I have one of them. It works fine. I happen to like it. But now a new form factor is coming out. I don't know what you want to call it, okay? In the PC world, we have what is called the desktop. We have what is called the notebook or the laptop. And with a telephony or the phone system, we have what is called a smartphone. And the smartphone's been getting bigger and bigger in display size. And the notebooks have been getting thinner, and smaller screens are coming out. But what separates the smartphone from the notebook? Well, there are two things that are... that people like about the smartphone. Number one is that it's always on. And, of course, if you power it off, it takes more than one or two. It actually takes maybe a minute or two before it could power back on again. But when it is when it's always powered on, whenever you need it, you go to it right away. And the other notable thing about a smartphone is if you happen to have data available, in other words, if you have the either Wi-Fi or you have a cable provider giving you internet service, you get on the internet right away. Well, those are the two things that people like about it. Of course, the fact that you can use it to watch TV and everything else because it's live online and but one of the things that people want is like in the iPhone X or 10 as they call it, or in the iPhone 8 and the Galaxy newer models, people seem to want a larger display. Well, a new form factor has come about, and it happens to be put forward by Microsoft. And what is that form factor? It's called an AC laptop. AC means always connected. Now, wait a minute. What do you mean by always connected? Well, what they mean by always connected is that it's always on. And when you want to use it, just turn on the display. Of course, your comment to me is, wait a minute, if it's always on, I'm going to run out of battery power very quickly. Well, one thing I love about competition is that without competition, progress is very, very slow. But with competition, wow, technological changes go at a great pace. I remember back in the my early days, back in the 60s, we had this teletype printer that printed at 15 characters per second, and it took a long time before we got high-speed printing. Well, it's nice to know that the biggest competition to Windows 10 is a big surprise, is Windows 10. In other words, the traditional Windows 10 is on a Wintel platform, meaning that it's Windows 10 running on Intel hardware. Well, Microsoft, being a very proactive, have teamed up with, guess what, the AMD chip manufacturers to come up with a new form factor called Windows 10 on ARM. And what it is that if you have it constantly connected, in other words, if you're in use with it, you got 22 hours of continuous active use on it, which, by the way, is longer than, I think, a smartphone. And if you just leave it in standby mode, in what they call the always connect mode, you could do that. Well, how long can you keep it in standby mode? 30 days. Wow. So right now, the initial one runs in 4G LTE 2. It can run in Wi-Fi. It's at least 20 hours of active battery life and at least 30 days of standby. And machines are starting to be delivered. And, of course, you think Intel is going to sit quietly by? No. They teamed up with AMD. I expect then that, you know, they will come up with their chip series to get into it. And that would be quite interesting. I'm looking forward to it. And would I buy a new machine because of that? Yeah, why not? Now, can you imagine? I used to think that, you know, I had a flip phone, you know, the Star Trek type of Motorola phone, and this was about 20-plus years ago. And it was sort of like, you know, you flip open the phone, you talk on the phone. Today, it's not uncommon at all. You see people holding a miniature tablet, or because when I talk about a large size smartphone, it looks like a miniature tablet, and they're holding it in a horizontal fashion and speaking into it. Well, I've seen people, you know, can you imagine that you're going to have a notebook that maybe you get the screen size down to 9 inches, which is like, you know, meeting some of the needs that want a larger size display smartphone, and you start talking into it, and people would think you're crazy or something. No, you're not. I really am looking forward to it. The other thing is that I was talking to Joe the other day, and he said to me, hey, Christmas is coming up. What are you recommending for stocking stuffers? I said, I don't know. You could always buy, in the old days, it used to be, well, you can always buy a box of floppy diskettes, or maybe a container or a spool of CD or DVD media. Today, I could say, well, you could buy some flash drives, and they come in different sizes, or you can buy a flash card. He says, yeah, but you know what? That is so ho-hum. Is there something that's more exciting than that? And then he says, well, what if you were to put something on it? I says, yeah. He says, why don't you do it for me? I says, now, Joe, come on. What do you want on it, all right? So I thought about it. You know, it's really it's something to think about, because one of the things that I've been working on is that I bought a Dell notebook last year on on Black Friday. And the problem I have with it is that at that time, it had a Windows Home installed on it. And it, we've had at least 2-3 updates since. And I had a devil of a time trying to get the Windows update on, because it only had 32 gigabyte of flash storage for, you know, flash memory storage. It's not a lot at all. And by the time you are, you can, you know, free up anything, and by the time you have Windows 10 on it, fully initialized, you're left with something like 8 gigabytes. Now, 8 gigabytes may sound like a lot, but when you start running anything, you'll find that with the virtual memory requirements, I would have a simple office function, and I originally had Windows Office on it. It would say low memory. You have less than a gig left. Well, I start looking at things at how can you free it up, and here's what I did. All right, with that particular unit, I had the option of installing a micro SD card. I put a 64 gig one on it, and I moved some of the stuff on it, and I find that I can move the documents and download subdirectories over to the subdirectory. But if I'm not really downloading anything and I'm, very frugal with how I use the memory, it doesn't really free up memory. Well, one of the other things I did was I went into the drive itself, and I said, okay, compress files where you can compress files. What this means is that instead of running a little faster where a module or a part of the operating system is being loaded, it is in compress mode, and when you load it, it has to expand. So it takes a fraction of a second or even a second more. Then I gain a little something there. And then I got up to around 10 gigabytes. But I said to myself, I need programs to run. What programs can I run? Well, it's called Portable Apps. And I did some research on it. I think you'd be amazed what portable apps are available. Now, portable apps are available for Windows operating system. Portable apps are available for a Mac OS X. Portable apps are also available for Linux. And, well, what do we mean by portable apps? Well, in the old days, when you install a program, what it does is that every program has operating parameters. And with those operating parameters, in the old days, they would store it and contain it within the program itself. Well, what kind of operating parameters? It would be like, what color do I want my fonts? What page size I'm using? Things like that. And, another thing would be like my dictionary, okay? If I'm doing a word check, I need a dictionary. So all those are operating parameters, and it's all part of it. What Microsoft did was, they were thinking about the business environment, and they're thinking about the word collaboration. Collaboration means, hey, you are working together. And then you have more than just collaboration working with others. You have programs that are running with the same modules. Like, for instance, in Microsoft Office, you have Word, you have PowerPoint, you have Excel, and you have the other lesser modules. But those three, they all have their own dictionary. Well, why not have them share the same dictionary? So instead of maintaining your operating system parameters in a self-contained program, you put it in the area that can be shared and looked at by others. When Windows was first released, there was something that was called WINI, WIN.INI. Everyone knew what that was. That means Windows Initialization Parameters. And then before we knew it, when we went to Windows 95 and start moving up, they started using a term called registry, and people were saying, what the heck is a registry? Well, registry is nothing more than operating parameters that is they put into the operating system area that can be looked at by the operating system as well as by other programs or other users that have the administrative rights to share with you on it. Well, that's for business, but for the average consumer, that's not really needed at all. Now, one of the questions I always get is, I have this old Windows machine. I want to go to a different operating system, but I got this application on it. And I would say, you have the distribution disk on it. He says, yeah, it's legit software, but I don't know where I put that CD or I don't know where I put the floppy diskettes. And the truth is, I'm like most people. I put things in a safe place, so safe I don't remember where I put it. So what happens is that you have to somehow either find it, and if you do find it, you have to reinstall the program. And people would say to me, why can't I just lift that program intact and move it to another machine? You can't, because the operating parameters were, when you installed it, were connected to the application itself. Well, a portable app is different. And what's been happening is that many applications have been adapted, and the operating parameters are self-contained within the program itself. So a portable app doesn't have to sit where the operating system sit. The operating the application itself could be sitting on a peripheral drive. In other words, a USB peripheral drive. And when you need it, it's there. And so I'll give you a good example, right? Let's say, and I do have it. I have Kingsoft Office, which is a portable clone of Microsoft Office, a pretty damn good one. And I put it onto a flash drive, and I could then invoke the writer or the spreadsheet module and use it. And anything that a mouse trail of information I have, it such as saving documents and codes and so on, it goes on the flash drive. It doesn't go onto the hard disk drive. So I can just easily just take a flash drive and ask someone, can I just use your system? I got to look at this or I have to do this. Guess what? It's great. And if you travel, if you happen to be going to a hotel that has a monitor and a keyboard and maybe a simple computer for you to use in the business office, you don't have to carry that stuff with you. All you have to do is carry the program on a USB flash drive. Now, when I started this a couple of years ago, I think people are familiar that I was working with it. There are now almost 1,000, easily 1,000 applications now that can be that are available as portable apps. And Joe said to me, if you were to put up one on a flash drive, what would you put on it? Well, what I put on is the test disk app, because it's a data recovery software in case I need it, in case of emergency. There's PhotoRec, which is, have you ever taken pictures with a digital camera? When you take that SD card or micro SD card out, you put it back in, somehow it's not readable. And the truth is, there may be a drop bit, there may be just one bit that's missing, but as far as the system's concerned, the whole thing is unreadable. Well, PhotoRec will say, it doesn't matter. You drop one bit, I'll just make like it's a zero or one, and we'll fill it in. And so in your final program, you see a dot here, dot there, no big deal. Then I also put a hardware information diagnostic tool on it. And by the way, Google Chrome, Mozilla Firefox, and Opera Portable, those are the latest ones. They are available in portable mode. So you might want to say, hey, I want those portable programs. Besides Kingsoft, there's also LibreOffice. OpenOffice is not up to date, so I wouldn't even mention it. But people use CCleaner, using Free Registry Cleaner. I use, and by the way, let me tell you about a great program. It's called ShowKey Plus, ShowKeyPlus. And what it is that it's a portable app, and if you run it, it will tell you what your Windows 10 product ID is. For those who have upgraded from Windows 7, do you know that if you better find out what the product ID is if you have to reinstall it, right? You don't want to forget about it. Well, maybe in the next one or two programs, I'll spend more time on this. There's even a backup program, but I'll get to that. Let's get to something else right now. We have a couple of very interesting segments to present tonight. The first will be Wearable and Health Technology by Dr. Alfred Poor, which he will cover 3D scanner identify skin cancer, facial recognition, artificial intelligence is used to identify viruses, and he'll talk about large organizations are buying fitness wearables for the employees. I will do a segment on legacy of PC equipment in 2020, rest in peace. Marty Winston will be covering home automation, in which he discusses the technology in digital addressable lighting interfaces for LED lighting control.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. Telecommunications and mobile electronics are transforming healthcare in ways that's almost impossible to keep up with. The story this week is about skin cancer. And one of the problems with skin cancer is it actually is the most common form of cancer for Americans. 1 out of 5 Americans are likely to develop skin cancer at some point in their lifetime. The problem is that it's difficult for even medical professionals to be sure about whether a lesion on your skin is likely to be cancerous or not. And so this inevitably leads to a referral to a dermatologist, a specialist who is better trained in these things and can look at it and make a decision and, if necessary, perform a biopsy to find out for sure. And the problem is that it's difficult to get an appointment with a dermatologist because it's a problem that so many people have. And according to one source, the average wait is a month or more for people to get an appointment to see a dermatologist. There's a company called 3Derm Systems out of Boston, and they've created a handheld scanner that a physician can put up against a patient's skin, and it will do a 3D scan of that point of the skin and will provide images that can then be sent to a dermatologist, an expert dermatologist, who can review those images and make a determination based on that whether or not there should be a follow-up visit. According to the company, this process can result in more than 50% fewer dermatology referrals for problems that are benign and not cancerous. So this can shorten the time that it takes for patients to get information back about the scan, as little as 2 days. And according to the company, they're 91% accurate at identifying skin cancer at its early stages. This will save money, save time, save lives, and it could be a game changer in fighting skin cancer. Let's talk about facial recognition. Yeah, we've seen it in the movies, in the spy movies, where somebody's walking through a crowded train station and the computers are able to get images from cameras and identify specific individuals out of thousands in the crowd. This same technology can be applied for recognizing other patterns. One very intriguing application is being developed by a company called Nano Global, based in Austin, Texas. And they're working with the semiconductor company Arm to develop a chip. It's an artificial intelligence chip that is designed for recognizing patterns. But rather than recognizing facial patterns, it's able to recognize the molecular patterns of biomaterials. And so, in other words, it's able to scan a sample, and out of all the molecules floating around in that sample, it can identify specific viruses, specific bacteria, and other chemicals that are associated with disease and illness. It's a pretty intriguing kind of idea. It could be very useful in the early detection of disease and leading to the earlier treatment of it. Here is a semiconductor chip that has artificial intelligence built in, which could provide early detection and earlier treatment of all kinds of diseases. I know I've talked about this before, but I'm going to bring it up again because here's another great example of it. In the beginning, fitness devices, fitness bands like Fitbit, basically were targeted at consumers, the exercise enthusiasts who wanted to track their workouts and monitor their fitness activities. That's a great way to get the industry started, but I don't think it's sustainable. I don't think that's where it's going to go. In many cases, you know, a lot of people buy these things, they wear them for a while, and then they end up in a drawer. To me, the solution is going to be when these devices start saving money, actually putting money in the pocket of somebody, that's when they're going to start being used and used reliably. For most people, if they exercise, it doesn't really save them money in a way that they see every week in their budget. But if employees are more healthy, if they're more productive, if insurance companies don't have to pay out as much in health claims for their insured people, those are the people who are going to benefit when people are healthier. And so it's my belief that the future for wearable health devices is going to be that they will be provided by health insurance companies, by major employers, by the healthcare providers, because those are the ones who are going to benefit the most financially from having healthier people. Here's another example. Samsung Electronics has recently announced a collaboration with United Healthcare and with Qualcomm Life. They're going to provide Samsung fitness wearables to all the people in this program. It's called the United Healthcare Motion Wellness Program. The people who are insured under this program can earn up to $1,000 in credits that can be used to pay medical co-pays and out-of-pocket medical expenses and things like that, pay for prescriptions. And all they have to do is meet the exercise objectives that have been set for them. The companies are providing this equipment. If the employees use it and benefit from it, they get a reward. They share in the savings that the company is going to get from them being in better physical shape, less likely to get sick, less likely to lose time and miss work. So everybody benefits and everybody shares in the rewards. So this is the future, I think, for these health wearables, that they're going to be bought not by individuals, but they're going to be bought by the carload, by the health insurers, by the large employers, by the healthcare service providers. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. There was a major news item that came out from Intel that they will be dropping all support for BIOS, the way we understand it, for setup, and they will be replacing it in the year 2020 with UEFI Class 3. And Joe said to me, is that really important? And I said, yes, but no one's going to understand what the hell you're talking about. I thought about it, and I said, you know what? I think I have to go into it in much greater detail. Well, Intel is going to be ending the legacy BIOS setup that IBM initially used for the IBM PC way back in 1981. And really, it was really quite useful, but it has many limitations now with modern equipment. As a result of all this, Intel is pushing for the development of a UEFI specs and contributed all that information as open license. The UEFI specs are now owned by the forum. Well, while modern PCs do ship with UEFI, and I'll explain what that is, most of them have a legacy BIOS made for using the hardware that might not be fully compatible with UEFI. Intel has announced that it's planning to end the support for legacy BIOS compatibility by 2020. That means that Intel will be only supporting UEFI Class 3, which means no legacy support. The BIOS Setup Utility is a program that controls communication between all input and output devices on the computer, such as disk drives, display, keyboard, mouse, scanners, printers, and so on. It is, however, limited to only 16-bit processor mode and 1 megabyte of addressable memory. UEFI, on the other hand, supports either 32-bit or 64-bit processor mode and can access all of the system's memory. Well, this is quite important because what it means is that you have to have the ability to communicate the peripheral hardware to the CPU itself. It was quite limiting to the equipment that it could be expanded to. Now, by dropping support on legacy BIOS, that means that any new operating system or anyone using the hardware, even to run an old operating system, will not be able to use the old peripherals. Between now and the year 2020, you have to look at some of the old equipment you have, and you may very well have to start planning on phasing it out. The BIOS, which is the old one, the legacy setup, uses a master boot record called MBR, whereas UEFI uses a new partitioning scheme called GUI ID Partition Table, otherwise called GPT. UEFI is able to support disk sizes greater than 2 terabytes, and a maximum disk and partition size of 8 zebibytes. I'll talk about that later. Exactly what is UEFI? UEFI stands for Unified Extensible Firmware Interface. It's a mouthful. It replaces the setup BIOS. The UEFI interface is a specification that defines a software interface between an operating system and platform firmware. When installing Windows on UEFI-based PCs using Windows Setup, your hard drive partition style must be set up to support either UEFI mode or legacy BIOS compatibility mode. UEFI was developed to allow support for new technologies during the booting process before the operating system loads. It is based on UEFI 1.10 specs that was originally published by Intel. For example, if you receive the error message, Windows cannot be installed to this disk. The selected disk is not of the UPT partition style. It's because your PC is booted up in UEFI mode, but your hard drive is not configured for UEFI mode. That's why some people, when they try to do a disk copy or clone a hard drive, try to reread that drive again. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And a lot depends on what mode it was configured on. Now, if you have that problem, you can reboot the PC in legacy BIOS compatibility mode, and this option lets you keep the existing partition style. For more information, you have to read up on UEFI mode or legacy BIOS mode. Now, if you have to configure your drive for UEFI by using the GPT partition style, and this option lets you use the PC's UEFI firmware feature. You can preserve your data and convert the drive using MBR to GPT2. Look that up. So in other words, if you have a hard drive that's set up for the old, you can convert it for the new setup for GPT partitioning. You can also choose to reformat the drive. Reformatting will erase all the data on the drive. Well, one question you may have is, how do you know if your computer is running EFI or UEFI or BIOS firmware interface? Well, here's what you do. You hit the Windows keycap, or you hold that down and you hit R. And then when it comes up, you type in MSINFO32, that's MS Info 32, and press Enter. When the information comes up, you look for the BIOS mode entry. And if the value listed is legacy, then the boot environment is the old legacy system. Otherwise, the respective boot environment will be listed. You know, we talk about UEFI as being Class 3 in 2020. Of course, Joe has asked me, well, what was 0, 1, 2, and 3? A Class 0 machine is a legacy BIOS setup only. There is no UEFI support on it. A Class 1 machine has UEFI as well as the legacy support on it called Compatibility Support Module, CSM. Class 2 machine is UEFI system that can run UEFI applications, but also includes the option to run in CSM or Compatibility Support Module mode. So this would allow you to, if you happen to have Class 2, to go back and forth between to run both equipment that is dependent on legacy BIOS as well as newer modern equipment for UEFI communications. Class 3 is UEFI system that does not support the Compatibility Support Module, and it will not be implemented with that backwards compatibility for legacy bootloaders. We're getting to the point where whatever equipment you have now, you're going to have to look at it carefully and say, well, it's time to upgrade, or do I still need it? This, I could see, will be a major problem where you have vertical applications with dedicated hardware. I could see this being a major factor in the medical area. I mentioned a zezibyte. I looked it up. A zezibyte is data storage that equals 2 to the 70th power. I won't bother to give you the numbers on it. And that is huge.
My editorial proof of concept project house, the 40-year house, 40yearhouse.com can tell you a little more, has every chance of becoming a dolly house. But I'd better explain about the old dolly that's gaining new playmates. Dolly, D-A-L-I, is an acronym for Digital Addressable Lighting Interface. And dolly isn't new, but most of you would not have encountered it. So far, it's been used mostly in industrial and commercial buildings. It's a two-wire network that can have as many as 64 nodes on it. Each node is a light, although they're called slaves in the context of DALI. And you can send the light's commands, zero or one states, we'll get into that in a minute, that turn them on or off or set a dimming level. So with 64 lights all connected on this two-wire low-current bus, nominally around 16 volts, give or take, it's possible to take a whole facility or set up several networks or jump between networks to control essentially any number of lights over something like these two wires. For those of you who live in a house with a lamp plugged into a wall and a switch on it, this might not seem terribly attractive. If you've changed all those lights to have LED bulbs, again, it may not appeal to you. But if you started looking at LED fixtures, or if you've started looking at automation for your lighting, or if you're taking a good look at your electric bill, then, gee, the idea of being able to control your lights either remotely, which we don't especially like, or automatically, which we do especially like, can be very, very appealing. Now, you start with an LED fixture. An LED fixture is not a socket with a bulb in it. It's the light complete. Usually, they're powered by DC. Sometimes, they're powered by AC. But an LED fixture is quite simple. When you've connected it to power, it turns on. There's nothing to screw into anything. And they last for somewhere between, nominally 50 years and two centuries. LED fixture lighting is really cool. And by the way, that 50 or to two centuries is based on what energy experts refer to as the three-hour rule, where the light's only on 3 hours per evening, you know, dusk till bedtime on average. And 50 years, many fixtures are in commercial spaces or retail spaces where they have to be on 24/7. So, no, it's not going to be 50 years. It might be 4 to 10 years. For the 250,000-hour ones, now you're talking about fixtures that can go 40 to 80 years. And because you don't need to keep them on in the dark, you're talking about fixtures that are good for the run of a 40-year maintenance-free house. So, okay, we've got lighting fixtures. We've got a way to turn them on and off, we think. Let me explain about Dolly. Dolly two wires are like that old modem your grandparents threw away. 1,200 bits per second. 1,200 baud. 1.2 kilobaud. 0.0012 megabaud or megabit, if you like. It's not very fast. It doesn't have to be. Think about it. It doesn't have to be. It's really only half that fast because you need 2 bytes in order to accomplish anything. The triggering is kind of interesting. Instead of looking for a high or a low, it looks for up transitions and down transitions. You know, it defines 0 as being close to the low voltage and 1 as being close to the high voltage, but it's a transitions account. Normally, it's held high and the pulses go down the wire, and that's how it reads the data it's being sent. The whole wire, 250 milliamps tops. 16 volts, 250 milliamps. You're not dealing with a lot of anything, right? So if I can control all of those things, what does a language read? Well, you have to specify what you're controlling. And with DALI, D-A-L-I again, with a digital addressable lighting interface, you can address a single light. You can do something called a broadcast that addresses every connected light. Or you can establish and define groups of lights. So things that are all, for example, along one wall in one room can all turn on and off together. Or everything in a coffered ceiling segment can turn on and off together. That would be a group, even though there are lots of separate lights to it. Might think about it as if you pulled an electrician in to wire your lighting switches, what would you want that to be like? Now, it's the commercial installations and the industrial installations that put Dolly in first because of the amount of money they have to spend in powering lighting, because of the amount of money they've had to spend in reducing the heat that lighting produces. Certainly not nearly as much in the LED generation as there was previously, but Dolly came to be initially to control the ballasts in fluorescent lighting. It's been around that long, and that's where it started. It was brought in as the successor to a dimming standard called 0-10, where 0 to 10 volts would establish some dimming level between, you think of it as fully dim to fully bright. It was seldom all the way off, seldom all the way on. And controllers in the early era would have a separate relay. So all the way on, all the way off were controlled by the relay turning on and off. And the dimming level controlled by a control circuit within that particular driver. Driver is a term you should know in LED fixture lighting. It's a thing that provides that fixture with exactly what it needs electrically to make the LEDs glow. The driver is generally connected to 110 volts, but there are also ways to deal with DC buses. This is a hodgepodge of things out there. Once you get into particular lighting design, it all settles down and it won't be confusing. With Dolly controllers under either manual or automatic controls, you have the ability to create scenes. It can memorize scenes. And you can say, set it up for daybreak, set it up for lunchtime, set it up for fire alarm, set it up for whatever you need. So we're starting to get really, really smart now. And it's a wired network, which means it's much less likely to be hacked. Also, Dolly can read status back from the lights to know how much power is being consumed, whether it's on or off, whether it's responding or not. And Dolly can also read when there's a power failure. And in the event of a Dolly system failure, to keep things safe, it just turns everything on. So Dolly is fairly intelligent, despite being very, very simple, easy to work with, easy to execute. But then you have to deal with somebody who understands to get the fixture, to talk to the driver, to talk to Dolly, you've got to make sure everything's intercompatible. So it's still, an area of technology that a lot of us have not yet touched, but those who do kind of love it. Dolly, by the way, is a little bit different from the DMX or DMX 512 standard that's used largely in things like theatrical and stage and event lighting, where you can get down to, again, individual or group light controls. But with DMX, you're dealing with a wider bus. It's more than two wires to talk to everybody. So you want to start with a major commitment to having that much controllability over that many wires in the installation. It's going to be a little more expensive and a little more complex. I should mention that there's some work on Dolly to extend the standard to involve Bluetooth mesh as a wireless way to communicate among the master and the slaves, the nodes. However, you know, that'll happen or it won't happen, and probably will. What's important about it is it's simple, it's flexible. Adapters and bridges and other things can make it work with other things other than Dolly, other public standards or proprietary standards. And it's also really, really good for dealing with the particular products that are out there in the LED market now. It's been commercial, it's been industrial. I believe it's going to be an attractive alternative for lighting control in new residential builds. But like with anything else in the house, anything else that uses power, anything else in the office, anything else in the plant that uses power, you've all heard Hank say, backup, backup, backup. And today, for just a few minutes, Hank asked me to address where those two come together. And there are two specific points in the control rack of the 40-year house where there's something about backup you may not have come to appreciate. And it is the fact that backing up over Ethernet, which many things do, has a bottleneck. It's a bottleneck because gigabit Ethernet has to share that pipe with other traffic, and because a gigabit is only a gigabit, divide by 8 to get the byte rate. Whereas a port, something like USB 3 or eSATA, lets you connect an external drive or drive array to do backups within the rack on a much faster basis that provides less intrusive code execution on the server that you're backing up. Hank doesn't say backup. He doesn't say backup, backup. He does say backup, backup, backup. And that's something I want to specifically address in the context of data backup. The two servers, one actually a workstation in the role of a server in the control rack of our cybernetic house project, are one for network video recorder, or NVR. It takes the inputs from 32 IP-connected cameras and deals with them, shares information, shares alerts about triggers in the visual field, all of that kind of thing. Very capable, and it's not like it is always dealing in traffic, but it has to always be available. What we're using for that is a Core i7. Essentially, it's a smart PC, a fair horsepower PC. But there's something about its drives that I want you to recognize. It is using RAID 6. That's a RAID redundant array of drives, a RAID array that can suffer two drive failures without going down, without even hiccuping. Two drive failures, a RAID array at RAID 6 is still just fine. So RAID 6 in that server, as it happens, our second server, which is the MySQL server, also a RAID 6 array in the server. So the servers themselves have a backup. Adding attached storage to each of those is where we have another layer of backup. Overnight, when there is likely to be slightly less load on either system, overnight backups happen and they are iterative backups. Only changed data gets written across the port and they are port connected. eSATA, very good. Other ports are available. You know, USB 3 is fairly fast. It's faster than Ethernet in these applications. But there is one other thing that I want you to know there. Those external attached storage boxes are running RAID 5, which can handle one failure in one drive in the array and still have whole cloth data available. RAID 6 in the server, RAID 5 in the backup, and I actually have backup. We won't even get into the power backup. I'll just throw it back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the tri-state area. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have its general meeting on December 14th, Thursday, at 7 p.m., and I've been asked to give a presentation on tips and tricks of the Personal Computer Show. The meeting will be at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 401 in Manhattan, New York. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on The Paperless Home, Thursday, December the 28th, 6:45 p.m., to be held at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on artificial intelligence, Tuesday, January the 2nd of the new year, 7:30 p.m., at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on ShopTech, Thursday, January 4th, 2018, at 7 p.m., Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be meeting on Friday, January the 5th in the new year, 8 p.m., and the topic of presentation is project integration, scope, time, and cost management, and they'll be meeting at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be having their meeting January the 12th, 7 p.m. on a Friday, New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, at the auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. Princeton PC Users Group will be having their meeting Tuesday, January the 23rd, that's in the new year, at 7 p.m., Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or wbai.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch. And keep on computing and backup. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.